Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme, QLS Classic Edition. This episode is from August 9th, 2017, with Kathryn Bigelow, director, Academy Award-winning director, Kathryn Bigelow. We go through her entire canon, especially her film Zero to Dark 30, The Hurt Locker, Detroit, and an unintentional comedy called Point Break. We hope you enjoy this. This is Questlove Supreme, QLS Classic Edition. Thank you.
World premiere,
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
To the entire world,
yeah,
I greet thee with hello.
Yeah.
Translation to Detroit.
Yeah.
What up, though?
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
Let's keep it dirty.
Yeah.
My skin complexion.
Yeah.
Zero dark 30.
Suprema roll call. Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
I'm pretty baked.
Yeah.
What's my point?
Yeah.
Point Break.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
I'm unpaid bill.
Yeah.
Y'all don't sue me.
Yeah.
Wanted to thank Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah.
For Gary Busey.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema roll call.
I'm Laia.
Yeah.
And I'm the shit.
Yeah.
Sitting next to an Oscar winner.
Yeah.
But I ain't gonna trip.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Boss Bill don't care.
Yeah.
About how you feel.
Yeah.
But Ron Silver.
Yeah.
Was ill and blue steel.
Yeah. Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
I'm Kathryn.
Yeah.
And peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
That was a mic drop noise.
Suprema roll call.
Fuck your roll call.
Wow.
That was
that's a ball. It was stark. She said one word.
Peace.
Dropped it.
You do what you want when you pop.
Yo, I'm so mad at you for that, Ron Silver.
What? No, he was ill and blue steel.
I know.
Nah, he was. He was. Yeah, he was. He was a motherfucker. Now.
Yeah.
Wow, you did blue steel?
I did.
Wow.
Yes. ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme, only on Pandora. This is your host, Questlove, and we have Team Supreme. We have Laia Gordy as the organizer.
Like Barry?
And we have Bill DeBarge, boss Bill DeBarge.
Is that a light skin joke?
Well, it could be.
Yeah, okay.
We have Fonte Robinson, our resident poet over here.
Being with you.
Yes. And over here we have Bill Ruffin.
That wouldn't be net without Bill Ruffin.
Exactly. And the smoothest of them all, we have Steve Gay over here on.
It's all good.
You heard it here.
On back. And are you okay? Are you okay, Steve?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If anybody hears me groan, it's not that you're boring. It's I'm in a lot of pain.
I was going to say, you're not trying out a new sexy voice. You're just...
No, this is it. This is all I got right now. This position. This is the whole thing. This is as much as I can muster.
That's well, sexy enough.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn the mic away when I'm not talking because I'm groaning and moaning.
Okay.
How's that need to
so it's just, again, you're not having a sexy moment.
No, I'm Steve Gay, but I'm not being sexy. I'm just being...
Can you make
anytime you talk, can I just put this on?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you make a couple of those noises?
Interesting I've ever sounded with that music.
It is.
Anyway.
Lonely.
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is a gripping storyteller, very intense and stark as a writer and a director. Such ashen, I'm sorry. Writer and director with such action classics as Point Break, Strange Days, K-19, and Blue Steel. By the way, I too have never looked at Ron Silver the same after that film came out. Yeah. However, in 2010, she made history as the first and only female to win the Best Director Oscar.
That's right.
Stronze. Give it up.
Stronze.
Stronze. For her Iraq War drama classic, The Hurt Locker, and her follow-up film, the equally gripping 2012 Zero Dark Thirty, also garnered universal acclaim, earning her New York Film's Critics Award for Best Director as well. And in 2017, she follows that up with her next film entitled Detroit. But, you know, for all my people up in Detroit, I secretly call it The D.
The D.
The D in my head.
Wow.
And it's a film that's centered around the Algiers Motel incident. One of the many stories that have occurred during the 1967 riots that really, you know, transformed that city into what it is today, kind of putting the long history conflict relationship between the police and the inner city residents on full display for the world to see. And if you think that she lets up on her intensity, think again, because it's intense as hell. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, the one and only Catherine Bigelow.
Thank you.
Wow. This is an honor to have you on the show.
Well, it's an honor to be here.
Normally, you know, we've been in our comfort zone with
Grammy winners.
With Grammy winners and music icons, but because of the city of Detroit and its relationship to music, and the 67 riots, which actually affected the outcome of a lot of the music that came out of that city, most notably Motown migrating to the West as a result of the end of Detroit. And for those that don't know, the central role that the group The Dramatics plays in this film, I thought it was only right to have you on the show. To speak of it. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm happy to be here. Happy to talk about it.
So I have to ask, because of okay, your filmography. I'm so used to saying your discography.
Yeah.
Or your canon. Yes, your canon.
Canon.
You know, you're probably, I mean, when all is said and done and we look at your canon, the intense level of your storytelling can't be denied. What is your goal as far as when you make a film? Like, what's your mission statement, at least? Like, when artists make a record, there's the mission statement that's usually like one or two, you know, phrases. This is my da-da-da statement or whatever. But for you, is it just to rip the ribbons and the bows off of the conventions of what Hollywood expects, and for you to just come at it raw?
Or like, rip the Band-Aid off.
Yeah.
I think up until Hurt Locker, it was, you know, kind of learning the craft. And then with Hurt Locker, I sort of discovered that you could kind of look at film like journalism. In other words, it could be about something you don't already know. And I thought that the Iraq War, it's a really contested engagement that was very underreported at the time, and I didn't know what an IED or an EOD tech was. And so it gave the audience an opportunity to kind of, perhaps maybe a bit immersive, but to experience what it might be like over there, so you could begin to make your own decision about it, you know. And so that was interesting to me. And so that was what, I suppose, informed Zero Dark Thirty as well. Like, you know, how does something that take 10 years to find this individual who is the most hunted man in the world? And so trying to unpack these stories and treat them almost like journalism. In other words, it's it's kind of both at the same time.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I, particularly with those two movies, I always thought that they took a very journalistic approach in that they're very kind of just the facts kind of way. Versus if you, like with The Hurt Locker in particular, if you look at someone like a Spike Lee who, his movies are very overt, like you know how he feels about everything in it. But with The Hurt Locker in particular, I love the movie, but you don't really know your personal feelings on the war. Like, what were your personal feelings about it, and how did you keep that bias out of the film?
It was hard. But I sort of looked at it like kind of threading a needle of being pro-soldier and anti-war, you know, if you could somehow do that. Mm-hmm. And also giving an audience the opportunity to have enough information to make their own decision. I don't think it's up to me to judge. You know, I feel like my role or responsibility is to present and then, you know, enable you to come away with enough information. But it is very hard. It's a good question because, you know, you're constantly wanting to, but wait a minute, I'm really passionate about, you know, I don't want to go, I don't want to be in this engagement. But anyway, so it's tricky.
Gotcha.
How do you tackle, I mean, especially with The Hurt Locker, One of the factors that are on full display is sort of the male toxic relationships that are in that movie. You know, even when they're not engaged in battle, just how they deal with each other. I mean, how do you, like, well, I guess Fonte kind of asked, like, how do you even present that without presenting your bias? Whereas a producer or a studio head could say, well, you know, or what are you trying to say with your agenda? That, you know, this particular demographic is somewhat messed up in the head or that sort of thing. Like, how do you even?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the writer was embedded with the EOD text, Mark Boal. Mm-hmm. And so he came back with a tremendous amount of information and really brought it to life on the page. And so that helped inform me a lot. And then I went to Kuwait. I went to Camp Arab Jam. I spent time in situ to the extent I can. I mean, I couldn't go the 5 kilometers across the border to Iraq, but I was in the staging area. So I got a sense of what, I suppose what the psychology is of these individuals. And so spent a lot of time with EOD techs and just, you know, you're in a really heightened scenario. I mean, you're trying to clear a 300-meter perimeter around some suspicious wires sticking up out of the ground. And as you get closer in that 300-meter walk, you have to, you know, at the beginning you're thinking of, well, it's 102 degrees outside. My IQ is dropping because of how hot it is inside the suit. But as you're closer and closer, they always talked about there's a 25-meter perimeter, and that's when you start thinking about your family. And it's just, you know, do I have everything in order? Is, you know, and so mm-hmm. It was interesting kind of understanding that degree of commitment and dedication, I guess. And yet trying to also understand the methodology of the insurgents. I mean, this isn't like a ground war, like, you know, where people wear different helmets and it's like, oh, they're the bad guy. I mean, you don't know who's who. And also you have to be very quick in terms of disarming this IED before your coordinates are called in by a sniper in the areas. You've got about maybe 3 minutes maximum to figure out how to unpack it. But so it was trying to, I don't know if I'm answering your question very well, but it was trying to understand, I guess what I try to do is create as experiential a situation environment as I can. So I keep the camera very live, keep the cast doing their job, not thinking about camera. I did the same thing with in the Algiers motel, where you're either against the wall or you're one of the officers. So it's keeping you on task.
Okay, well, that leads me to my next question.
Okay.
Because I always feel as though camera number one is also a character in the film. How do you, because a lot of the, you do hard panning, you do a lot of hard panning instead of cuts. Whereas I really feel like, okay, I'm a character in this and, you know, I'm inside of this world. How do you even coordinate the choreography? I mean, I'm thinking of like The Founder almost where.
Oh yeah, they're making the hamburgers.
Exactly. Like as far as the technical preparation is concerned, how do you do it so that you maintain the key elements of the scene without him being in the way or the actors being distracted, like, you know, like.
Well, I mean, first of all, you've got this story, this narrative beginning, and that's somewhat linear. That's all that's linear. Everything else is in motion. The cast is in motion. The cameras are in motion. I light the entire area. So everything is live. And then I try to work in situ as long as possible. In other words, like you could do 8 pages if you wanted to. In other words, I try to keep it in as continuous as possible. But I keep it very live, and then eventually, usually just within the first couple of days, the camera disappears for them, and they're kind of on point. They're doing what they are who they are. Like in terms of Jeremy Renner in Hurt Locker, he was just walking down that 300-meter perimeter. It didn't matter. I mean, the cameras were constantly switching up, take after take. I had 4 cameras working simultaneously. And you just, I mean, I think in a way it's kind of freeing. He had never worked like that before. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of freeing. There's no blocking. There's no blocking for camera. There's no marks. There's no rehearsals.
No practice? No.
Nothing. No.
So are you coordinating like a defensive coordinator? Because even then, like, when there are certain scenes where there'll be a certain shot, and then suddenly, on cue, the camera will pan in, like, and I'm always wondering, like, are you in someone's headphones? Like, okay,
no, I wish I did.
Immediately now, like, so they just do it on instinct. You trust them enough to know when to blur out the shot and then focused and.
I need that technology, but no, Barry Ackroyd is. He's a genius. He's a cinematographer in both Hurt Locker and Zero Dark, and Hurt Locker and Detroit.
Right.
And he's so uncanny. He's so intuitive. I mean, he'll snap zoom like.
He just knows what you want.
He just knows. Yeah, we talk it through, and then he feels it. In fact, he doesn't want to see a rehearsal. He wants to find it in that first take, and he talks about that. I mean, that's very important for him.
So you're like a jazz musician.
I was just going to say, it's like a jazz
musician. Like a jazz musician.
You know, because it can't be rehearsed or mechanical. Then it loses something.
Are you ever over the editor's shoulder? Or do you just turn your tapes in and you just trust that they know what you want? Like, at what point do you let your baby go and trust that they will cut what was in your head at the time when you're thinking of the shot? And a certain scene.
Well, I also have, the, just in my opinion, the world's greatest editor, Billy Goldenberg, who did Zero Dark and Detroit. Mm-hmm. And what's, this style of shooting, there's no masters, mediums, close-ups, doesn't work like that. You're just, everything is constantly in motion, like the actor may walk around the Humvee and then suddenly he is in a close-up. Or, in other words, it's very fluid. So Billy takes this, which in a way is very chaotic, can really seem very chaotic, but he creates the linearity, and I trust him completely, and I am there, but...
So you are there?
I'm there.
See, I've heard, well, I mean, not that I know that much about filmmaking, but I do know that, like in the case of Martin and Thelma,
right.
He says that the second he's done a film, Scorsese just gives Schumacher his films, and it's like, it's on you. You know what I like. And I come back. Like, there's always an issue of micromanaging or that sort of thing, like not letting go. And I didn't know if it was an unwritten rule that once a director finishes shooting, then you just give it to the editor and trust that they know what they're doing.
Well, I trust completely, and I'd love him to, you know, find a certain autonomy. But I think he would agree, hopefully I'm speaking for him, but I think it's a real collaboration with the crew, with the cast, with everybody. It's a real collaborative medium. And I think it's at its best when it's collaborative.
Can I ask you, seems like, and I might be assuming, but it feels like Hurt Locker was the beginning of a 100% passion project for you, like a chapter, because Hurt Locker, of course, and then Zero Dark 30, Detroit. I wanted to know, is that the case, or what is the what happened in between to, number one, to get to the point where you could do this? Are these your 100% passion projects? And yeah, what was the transition to that point? Because of course you did so many movies and projects before that, but these last three seem like
you're in your zone.
Yeah, and this is your heart.
And let me get in my zone.
Well, I feel like the films before them, and of course, you know, you kind of, I don't know, you can't have favorites, you know, mm-hmm. but I feel like they prepared me for those, and I couldn't have done Hurt Locker or Zero Dark or Detroit if I hadn't done those. Mm. And one thing that was a real departure was working with emerging talent, or, you know, mainly unknown talent. Mm. And I kind of made that in other words, if you wanted to finance or produce The Hurt Locker, you had to work, or that was a prerogative, creative control.
Okay.
And let me tell you, that winnowed out a lot of options out there, you know, and then there was this one gentleman who took the leap, and for very little, relatively, for a movie like that, small amount of money, and I was able to cast exactly who I want, cut it the way I wanted, and so
is the first time that you were able to do that in your whole career.
How hard is it to find a producer that's not
trying to,
for all intents and purposes, a pain in the ass? Because, you know, I, at least in my experiences of witnessing, usually the good cop is the director and the bad cop is the producer, you know, and they have to stand on the side, let you know the budget that you're running over, and this sort of thing. I mean, how easy is it to find, or how hard is it to find one that gives you complete autonomy? Because there were years before. I think K-19 came out 6 years before.
Seven.
Not knowing what the budget for The Hurt Locker was, but I can imagine that however you pitched it, obviously, for that and for Zero Dark 30, that it was pricey. And you know, of course, we're not mentioning the elephant in the room about, you know, are women given the same amount of trust behind the wheel as a male director? We all know that answer is no. So how did you break through to the other side to even, this is a lottery ticket.
It's a lottery ticket. Well, you have to be very tenacious. And, well, the first budget for Hurt Locker was $30 million, and I ended up making it for $10 million. So that,
wow. That's a first.
Wow. Wait,
I don't believe it.
So
don't even have my siren. Damn it.
But how do you get a budget from 30 to 10?
Well, that's
and unknown actors.
And didn't lose any set pieces either. So
wow.
So that was a little tricky, but or a little challenging. But the key there was, and what I realized was that the budget and your creative control are in direct proportion to one another. So that was for that. So the lower the budget, the more creative control you have. So you're going to sacrifice and compromise creative control if you want more money. So that's just, it's a very simple calculus. And I kind of wrapped my head around that and went forward with it. And obviously with Hurt Locker, that turned out well. And Zero Dark was a little bit more money, but not, I mean, it wasn't outrageous. It was, but I would be considered a kind of fairly robust budget, but nothing in terms of, I don't know, like one of the more normal big movies today.
Well, okay, because I know that Zero Dark is also intense on the drama and the dialogue that's just as rich as an action scene or that sort of thing. Now I'm trying to imagine, if you were given complete autonomy to do, you know, say if you were given a $70 million budget, or, you know, some films of this nature get a $150 million budget, like, what more could you have done? Like, is there a sacrifice scene that we didn't know about that, like, okay, well, right. we only got $10 million, so we'll just use this firecracker over here.
I'll just blow up this town. No, that's another thing. I think, you know, I do, when I can, I work in elephant conservation or some kind of philanthropy, and I think, you know, the bigger the budgets, I think, wow, I should be using this money for that, you know, saving these park rangers in Garamba in the DRC or something like that. But so, but finding a producer that supports you and trusts you, I mean, that's, it's a process. It's a I mean, I also produce, but in other words, I'm a producer and director. So I
You're
see
a suit
cost
and a creative.
I'm a suit and a creative, but, but, you know, I know, you know, I know who wins in my, in my own personal,
right.
Yeah, you just, you know, but I think working with as much trust, integrity, and respect as you possibly can. And then, I mean, with everybody, crew, casts, producers, et cetera. And then, you know, it's usually a, you kind of, I mean, that's sort of what I learned prior to the Hurt Locker. And then, of course, tried to execute it from that point on.
So you're proven, you're reaffirming what I've always thought about musicians, which is whenever they have limited resources and limited budgets, they turn out their most creative work. And whenever they're just given the entire world, that's usually the that's the jumping the shark moment for a lot of our musicians.
Well, there's a great quote by Andre Gide. It said, art is born of restraint and dies of freedom.
Man. That's very true.
Isn't it?
And that's Questlove Supreme. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Peace.
Peace.
We out.
Oh, man. I have a question, Steve Day.
Moner.
And then I really want to hear about Detroit after...
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to Detroit. I kind of want to.
My question is, because you mentioned the journalistic nature of the making of these movies. So, do you have any kind of background in journalism? Or?
No, but Mark, who wrote all three of them, comes from investigative journalism, and so that allowed me to kind of open up that idea of being a, you know, putting the viewer in an active relationship with the screen as opposed to passive, you know, that can't, consequently, the camera's very active. But in other words, sort of inviting the viewer to be a fly in the wall in what you're experiencing.
Follow up?
Yeah. I'll change your last. You can be Stubbs. Yeah. Steve Stubbs.
So I was watching the CNN thing in the 90s, and I saw your name as a director on... what was it? A long time ago.
Point Break.
No.
It was a show. It was
Homicide. Life on the Street.
Homicide. Life on the Street.
Yeah, Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's you, right?
Yeah.
So, I thought I was having another one of those.
That was really cool.
I love you, Steve.
But that was somewhat journalistic type thing too, as well, right?
Well, I started. That was sort of where I began to get confident enough to move, you know, to be, I don't know, create a very, I suppose, sort of active and fluid cinematic environment. And then, I don't know, you just kind of get your chops. I mean, it's got to be like what all of you do.
Wait, so what was your first gig in the film industry? Because, Catherine, you have like actress, producer, writer, director, all these things on your name. What was your first?
Yeah, I'm going to add some more. No, I'm kidding.
You should, as you should. Hey. Do whatever.
Well, I started out as a painter, and I was an artist, and or thought of myself as an artist, and moved to New York. I was given this, internship with the Whitney Independent Study Program. They gave you a studio. I was living in a bank vault and on the corner of Reed and Chambers. And
when?
Many years ago.
Pre-gentrified New York?
As you
like,
do.
No, very pre-gentrified. Off-track bedding building, and I was downstairs in this bank vault.
Damn.
And Susan Sontag was one of my advisors. She'd come down, and I'd put the work up on the wall of these stainless steel. And the door, I mean, I had nowhere to stay. I had a sleeping bag in the bank vault, and I'd sleep in there, and people would be, there were gunshots above. But I was like, okay, I'm safe down here as long as the door doesn't shut.
Right. Small breasts. Right.
Small breasts. The door shuts. No, nobody's going to find me. But so I would do these paintings, and then I realized that art, and I love it. Believe me, I still, you know, I kind of
dabble a little bit.
That's how you're online.
No. I mean, I still look at it and. No. It can't be a hobby. I wish it could, but anyway. So no, it's not relaxing at all.
Oh, wow.
But I realized there's something, you know, kind of. I don't know how to put it, but maybe kind of rarefied. You look at this white on white canvas, which is this Russian guy, Kazimir Malevich, who I love. But the point is, it's, you know, requires or asks of you a little bit of information to kind of appreciate it and think this is extraordinary and breakthrough or Monet's haystacks or whatever. And so then I started moving into film because I thought it crosses all class cultural lines. Yeah. Like everybody can go to the movies. And so how do you work in a populist medium with an emphasis on content? And so that's where it started. I did this piece set up, and then I ended up doing a graduate degree at Columbia, and I was getting too long of an answer, but I did this movie called Setup Movie. It was a short. It was 20 minutes, and it was very violent. I know, there's a thematic.
Really?
Shocker.
A real breakthrough. No. And... but what was interesting to me was why we are attracted to extreme situations. And Susan Sontag wrote that book on photography, and she talked about identifying with the other and or the id, you know, and your so anyway, it's basically a piece that tries to unpack our attraction to cinematic violence. And it's only 20 minutes long, sort of non-narrative. And then that kind of propelled me into the motorcycle movie I did with Willem Dafoe called The Loveless.
Mm-hmm. Willem Dafoe. He must be special to work with.
He's fabulous. In fact, he was doing, you know, he used to be with the Wooster Group. And that was back in the day when you can just go to a performance and then you go up afterward and you say, hey, do you want to be in a movie? I mean, I had just, you know, 5 pennies to make this film. And he's like, sure. I said, can you ride a motorcycle? He said, yes. Well, I learned. I learned. You know, it's good to kind of like
research
these questions, especially when we ended up. Anyway,
how many times he fall?
No, he didn't fall. He just ended up going through a hedge and up a lawn and into hitting the front door. We had these big electric glides back in the day. There was Ghost motorcycles out in Long Island. I don't know if any of you, are old enough. No, and they had vintage motorcycles, and this was a film that took place in 1959, and so I wanted all the motorcycles to be real, and so they're heavy, and I can't drive one, but so that was how the switch happened, and then suddenly I was making film.
What is your attraction to, I don't want to use violence as, you know, as the four-letter word, but there's definitely, that's an element that's almost a common denominator in each film. Like, I became aware of you through Blue Steel, as we mentioned at the top of the show. But what is it that you want to tell the world or show the world through all of your films that you direct or you write? Like, what is your, because you wrote Blue Steel, correct? Mm-hmm. You wrote and directed. Mm-hmm. So why is that your way to grip our collars or to get our attention?
Well,
because you use it in a very unusual, it's not gratuitous as in like, hey, it's gratuitous, but it's almost psychological where you go deep into all these characters and you show this dark place in their soul, which makes me wonder about you. What's the dark place in your soul, Catherine Bigelow?
Well, we could turn this into a therapy set. No,
there's couches.
Right, I know. And I co-wrote that with Eric Red, and we co-wrote Near Dark together too. But I think of Well, I don't. I suppose it's goes back to the art days, where the purpose of art is to agitate for change, and so I think a film is very kinetic. It's a very kinetic medium, and I sort of enjoy the mechanics of that kind of visceral identification with a story on the screen. Mm-hmm. But it has to have content. It has to have some purpose. There has to be some, to say meaning is too self-aggrandizing. I don't mean it that way, but to have, it has to have some substance.
Right.
And I think what's so great about film is it allows you, and music, to be a part of something so much bigger than yourself. And, maybe ever so slightly you can perhaps make a difference.
I want to ask you about when you cast your films and the training that you put your actors through. Obviously for The Hurt Locker, there was, it had to be some kind of military training, or what was the regimen for that? And also for Detroit, because the guys are playing a singing group, what did you have them do to so that it looks real on camera?
Well, thank you.
Any sort of camp or...
There was Motown camp. No, we didn't.
Oh, wow.
No. Well, in terms of Hurt Locker, yeah, they went through a lot of military training. I mean, and same with Sarah Dark. I had the benefit of, in the case of Hurt Locker, there were some Delta Force individuals that were my tech advisors and SAS. And then with Zero Dark, Navy SEAL. Mm. Tech advisors, and taught them how to, how to move, and how, the most important thing I took away from that was don't run to your death. It's very methodical how these people move. It's really interesting. Like, you'll be coming around a corner and you don't race around it. You move very slowly and incessantly. It's like they talk about it, like the trainers would talk about it, like water, the way water moves. Mm-hmm. Its cadence doesn't change. It's just very consistent. It has nothing to do with Motown, but I'm somebody, I think, who's musically challenged. In fact, I don't know how old I was. I did a piano recital at like 1.5. I don't know. I was very young, and the teacher hit my hand with a ruler. I was doing something wrong, and so I told my parents, "I'm never doing that again." So I started painting, but anyway, so I was extremely lucky because I'm not conversant in that world, and finding these actors, and I did a lot of improv. I didn't ever work from the script. I worked basically in improv, created a situation like, okay, you're up against the wall, this guy's going to come in, and I needed to see how they would react in a situation, and then how they would work together as musically. Mm-hmm. And I think I think they just blended. I don't know. There was just a natural blend, and they kind of, and then they got together a lot during the shoot and prior in the casting process. They would get together and really created a sense of history, and that carried over into the onto the scene.
When you do it, do you have someone in mind? Like, when you looking at the story, do you have someone in mind saying, hey, I think this actor or this actress would be good for this role? Or is that something that totally you let the casting?
I had an amazing casting director, Vicky Thomas, but I really wanted actors who, in a way, didn't have any provenance, because that... telegraphs to an audience, even if it's consciously or subconsciously, oh, that person, he can't die, he's too famous, or whatever.
Right.
And so immediately the game is over, there's no tension. So for that reason, and also just, I love the idea of kind of these discoveries, and these young African-American men were just, they were so giving and so... they're so talented. It was an embarrassment of riches. It was very, very, very hard to cast, because for any one part, there were quite a few options.
Well, you did a great job, because I didn't even recognize John Krasinski.
And oh, so, yeah.
5 minutes. I was like, oh, it's Jim. Right. And I was waiting for the office pan. Like,
right. And the young black actors that you picked are like right now the up and coming. Just off a name, you got Ralph, like Eazy-E, you got Ralph Tresvant, you know? These are the characters, but I mean, that they play, but, and it's dope too, because I was thinking, I said, you know, they're used to being in these dope ensemble cast, even John Boyega, I don't know if I say his name right.
Yeah,
but
yeah, perfect.
Star Wars ensemble cast, so it kind of worked dope for you because they are used to making it work for one grid mission, right?
Yeah, I mean, they work, yeah, they're well versed at working as, you know, as a group and as a kind of an organic body that, you know, I mean, I was just so lucky, and Algie Smith and Peyton and Malcolm and
Will Putler. I'm glad. I never knew his name, but I've been watching him since he was a child actor. He's amazing.
Oh, that's great.
He's scary.
He is.
Even if I see him now.
I know you.
Like, he's on the Goldbergs, right? Is he not on the...
I don't know if he's on there now.
He was in The Revenant.
He was in The Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I know that. But yeah, he's... Oh, Jesus Christ.
He's scary looking. It's an eyebrow thing.
Even if you mention it now, I'm like, all right, change the subject. Sorry. I don't know how I'm going to feel when I see him come on my show. And I'm playing. I want to know, what is your personal creative process? From going project to project. Now, I mean, the time distance between Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker was 2 years, almost. Now, I would imagine, usually for anyone else in any other medium, when someone reaches that level, that summit, that pinnacle of a career... You, of course, making history as the first female director to get an Oscar nod. Usually, for anyone else, that would be like, okay, well, a period of decompression, and you might take 5 years off to think of your next move. Like, let's take Lin-Manuel Miranda, for example. Like, I'll be shocked if he comes up with a follow-up to Hamilton in the next 5 years. Like, I'll be shocked.
I'm doing Jefferson now.
Right, right. But yet, you know, you immediately, I mean, for me, that's almost lightning fast of how you just went on to the next project. Like, it was nothing. You didn't let it freeze you up or anything. But I want to know, you know, do you have a... kind of a decompression resting period that lets you back at zero so that you can go to the next project? And then what's your research into? Like, as far as you deciding, okay, this is what I want to do next. And then, you know, making sure that you and your screenwriter are on point with each other, and then mapping out the direction and all the things that go with creating a film. Like, what is your creative process? And in relationship, especially with Detroit, the research you had to do and the books you had to read and all those things.
Yeah, the research on Detroit was massive. What happened was Mark came to me with this story, and this was early 2015. And right about the time of the Michael Brown acquittal. Mm-hmm. And so it was, kind of obviously a politically, emotionally charged time, and he told me this story, and I said, you know, this is a story that needs to get out there. You know, it's very important, in my opinion, and you know, maybe in some small way it can contribute to a conversation on a bigger scale. And then I started doing homework on it, and in fact, I sat down with Congressman Conyers, who's in the movie, but in Detroit, and he kind of looked at me and said, "Okay, what are you doing? You know, what kind of movie are you doing in Detroit?" I said, "Well, I'm doing a story about the Algiers Motel," and he said, "That's an execution," and so I realized that there's a lot of obviously a lot of history, even though it's 50 years ago, and then the, you know, what happened with Michael Brown, and on and on.
And this timely.
And this time, it felt very timely, and it felt like this might be you know, I don't know, worth be incredibly moving to dig into. And the more research I did, the more homework we did, and trying to make it as real and authentic as possible. And it was a very emotional piece. It was very emotionally charged shooting it as well.
Did you have any reservations about doing this? Because I was reading the article that Dr. Dyson wrote on you, and I remember the part where he, one of the people in Detroit, because you guys are walking around Detroit, and he says, like, what is this? Is this white woman going to know about us and this story that we have? Like, did you personally have to have a moment and say, can I do this? Should I do this?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought, and I think, I still think, you know, am I the perfect person to make this movie? Absolutely not. On the other hand, you know, I have this opportunity. I can get this, you know, I can get this story out there and you know, take advantage of that in the hope that, again, it maybe leads to a dialogue or more stories like this coming out. And so that was the impetus behind it.
When you say you're not the perfect person, if not you, then who? Like, who would, if you were producing Detroit, who would you get to direct it?
Is that an Ava thing?
Yeah, I mean, she'd be amazing. Yeah. Exactly. So, but, it kind of washed up on my beach. And so it was sort of like, all right, I don't know. You know, that took a, there was a moment there. Mm-hmm. I was trying to kind of grapple with that. And
it's weird because even when I saw the screening of it, I did not know that the story even happened. And, you know, I'd like to think that anything musically related, like, I'm on top of. I mean, I knew of riots being in Detroit, and I knew, I've heard several interviews of why Motown had left. You know, I simply thought it was because, okay, well, Diana Ross wants to make movies, and so let's go out there. I had no idea that, you know, Detroit was in that intense of a disarray. And so the first thing I thought was like, well, why wasn't this? I think Bill was the first person I called about this, and he looked it up and was like, yo, yeah, it was real. And, you know, he researched it online. Like, I couldn't believe that. The thing is, it's not, because you didn't do a biopic about the dramatics. More or less, the dramatics just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and you captured it. And even then, I was like, wow, like the 4 or 5 times that I've seen the dramatics. I mean, that would be like if I met Rodney King and he never told me about April 1991. You know what I mean?
So I was driving one night. Things got a little out of hand.
Right.
But anyway.
Yeah. And I kept thinking, like, on the way home, I was like, wait a minute, man. I've been, at least in the 4 or 5 times I've been in the presence of the dramatics in my career, like, it's at least been an accumulated 3 to 4 hours. I'm like, man, they didn't mention this once. Like,
maybe it wasn't the worst thing that happened to them.
Well, here's the funny thing. Here's the funny thing, because I've talked about violent situations that they've been in. Mm. In Snoop's second source cover, when his solo album comes out in 1993 and Dream Hampton's sort of trailing them during the making of Doggy Style, there was maybe an exchange of gunfire between the van that the dramatics were in.
What?
And maybe the family that, remember, Snoop had an incident.
Murder when the gang.
Yeah. I'm innocent. Philip, I don't want to just reduce him to. Yeah. Ooh, how did you.
I remember.
That's you.
That's what I do.
Well, yeah, I mean, the article came out 25 years ago, but I remember the dramatics being in that situation. And then when Slum Village told me a story, sort of similar, that it was like a minor fender bender, like they were with some members of the dramatics, and DJ Dez told me, like, you know, like they were about to get into a a violent situation. I was thinking, like, man, the Dramatics are like the most unluckiest group on earth. And I'm talking,
or gangster.
Yeah,
or
gangster, yeah.
Or they just like the drama.
There you go, Steve.
Steve.
I earned up to your name.
Good night. Yeah, yes. Good night. Thank you, Steve. So yeah, but in talking to them about those situations, yeah, man, oh, whew, it was intense that day.
But
like, nothing, they never said,
but it was
nothing,
but that
never
to,
compared right. to that. They just, I just, that's the first thing. I was like, why did they not tell me about 1967? Like, why did I not know this? Even in the film, I kept asking, half the time I was like, IMDb, I'm like, wait a minute. Is this the Dramatics Dramatics? That,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, the Dramatics.
The Dramatics, I know what you see is what you, and then when they started singing it, then whoever is running the, I don't know if you told them not to tell me or whatever, that you just wanted me to see it raw and that sort of thing. So I went back to him. I'm like, yo, is this story real? Or? And he said, just watch it, you know. So half the time I was just like trying to follow up facts. And
it's just a long story. They're probably so sick of telling it. It's like probably takes 2 hours to tell the story.
Yeah.
The length of a movie, rather.
You know, and I don't want to get into spoilers. So I'm trying to figure out a way to talk about the film without getting into specifics, so as to not ruin it for the listener. But I mean, I will say that in this, the film's like, what, 2 hours and 20?
220, yeah.
Yeah, 2 hours and 20 minutes. I mean, you spend a great deal in the center of the film. What, 35, 40 minutes?
Oh, probably a little bit more, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, 50 minutes, almost an hour on this one. It's almost like it turns into a play because you're literally in this room during the torture scene, whatever you want to, the interrogation, torture, death game scene, for an hour with just one camera. And
how many people in that room? How many 11, people being tortured at this?
In the hallway?
Yeah.
In the hallway, there were about nine.
Okay.
And then
nine and four cops. Or, I mean, depending on the army guys and whoever
exactly.
was in the...
Like three Detroit police and one National Guard.
Is this almost the movie stops and then goes into meta mode inside of itself and then starts all over again with this torture scene. And
sounds like another Oscar for Catherine, the way you're coming on.
I just and it's weird because even when you and I were talking, because I mean, it's no secret, like, you know, the Roots worked on the song at the end. I mean, there was two ways to go with the direction of that song, because with films that intense, and when it's time for the credits, you need a moment to breathe, to process what you just saw.
Catharsis.
That's what Catherine was saying about the song earlier, right? You were breaking down, it's not just a song. It's...
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's so emotional, that song. I think it's phenomenal. And it also shifts time periods. Yeah. You know, takes you from the 60s to now, back to the 60s. And I think it's a good release for the kind of anger that one might feel.
We wrote the song It Ain't Fair, and I wanted to give the listener release at the end, but I also remembered that I was mad as fuck at just angry as shit, and I wanted to convey all those things in that song.
On the movie or just period?
You know what I felt? I had a long conversation with seeing the film twice. I kind of had a post-viewing conversation with the people I was with, and kind of hearing both sides, because, you know, I was with white and black people. Mm-hmm. And it's weird, the white people that saw the film with me were like, okay, you know, I have to admit that it took this film for me to really truly understand Black Lives Matter.
Jesus.
And this person is a liberal.
Jeez, but they're the worst. Sorry.
It's but they no, are. But that's
it's, they are.
What it is.
They are.
This person's a liberal, yeah. But it's sort of like, well, I hear what you're saying, but it's almost as if this film really allows
drove
you.
Drove it home.
Yeah, this film really allows you to put yourself in that person's shoes. Because this is one thing to just watch the news thing. And there's always the thing in the back of your mind like, okay, the brother in Minnesota.
Philando. Philando Castile. Okay.
Where, you know, I still, you know, liberals that might say, okay, but okay, what really happened? Okay, did you flinch?
All the facts to come in.
Right, exactly. We're waiting all the facts to come in means that you're given the benefit of the doubt that
we never fucking get.
Right. And it was like, as we were watching the film, I kept watching the energy of the room, and the white side was sort of like, wait, what's going on here?
This what we've been trying to tell y'all, motherfuckers. Right.
Right.
Going on.
And
they're Trump awakening.
It's real. And it's, you know, I kind of had to explain to them that, yeah, like none of us. And the thing that it hit home to me was that, again, with the dramatics and what they went through, not trying to spoil it, but I was even like, wow, like how do you even
go on,
continue as a group? Or function with your life after this.
Yeah, what was the album they made after
that?
what is that record?
Yeah, but it's like, how do you go on? And so it was, you know, I mean, tears were shed. And there were all sides of it. Because even on the black side of things, they were just like, yo, man.
Shouldn't be
like,
a white girl.
That's... No,
I'm sure somebody said it.
I mean, I've had arguments of intense levels with, you know, well, you know, why the fuck they stand up for themselves and be like, yo, fuck y'all. And, and I'm just like, dude, when you're, I always call this the Price is Right syndrome. The Price is Right syndrome is that when you're watching the Price is Right in the comfort of your home,
you know the price.
Yeah, you know that turtle wax.
Right.
Turtle wax is $8.99, you know. But when you're on the Price is Right, it's like $1,000. It's like you always know the answers when it's not when you're not there.
Yeah.
And I've been in situations, and this is the thing, because I'm sure that you've definitely been in a situation, Fonte.
Absolutely.
Bill come from Indiana is probably definitely, and Laia has been in a situation where, I mean, even today, I mean, I'll say with all casualness that, you know, maybe my average of getting stopped, it's, you know, six times a year. It's like, I expect every January, okay. Mm-hmm. And I think about it a lot, like, wow, I'm going to have six run-ins with and it's to the point where I gotta over prepare. Like, I keep extra Lego hearts in the car.
What? You give them out to cops?
No, three times. Like, you know, because if I want to go out and be comfortable and not have to take selfies, I wear a hood, I braid my hair, I wear dark glasses. It buys me 10 seconds of,
yeah
I know you're looking like Amir, you're not ever you, but yes, it works sometimes.
Right.
I can sneak in movies. And I'm cool. But woo, when that shit happens, put on jazz music.
Put on jazz music.
No, for real.
Like, do not turn your head to look back.
You're programmed. I mean, you can either be like, all right, fuck it, I'm down for the cause, and Queen Latifah your way out that car.
What?
But then it'd just be Laia Supreme.
Set it off. I'm sorry.
Set it off. I was making a set it off reference.
I got it.
Or it's like, you know, the second they see, wait a minute, I got stopped by ICE.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. This summer.
What is that?
This summer in California.
What is that? What is ICE?
Immigration.
Why they stop?
La migra.
I was. We were driving. I was being driven from my gig in San Diego, which has a lot of activity of fence jumping and whatnot. Right. Like, they have the little signs of families like running the border, like, beware the, you know, like you see deer warning. Well, they have signs of like
so fucked up. Yeah. It's like a shadow.
It's like a shadow. A shadow of four family so members running, racist. And the baby got a little teddy bear. I'm like, why do they have a blanket and teddy bear? Like,
so they think you stashing a family of Mexicans in your black Suburban?
Well, like, they stopped my driver, and you know, I was asleep, but she told me like, you know, they stopped us, and I said, what happened? And she's like, well, you know, I'm driving my client from his concert, and da 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 da, and they said, well, who's your client? So I got a question for Love from the Roots, and they were kind of like, okay, likely story. Female driver, blonde.
Yes, I know. That's why I'm looking at.
And so they made her roll down. Now
you sleep. You don't even know none of this.
Yeah, I was.
Traumatic for you.
Right? They abused you.
But no, I'm saying that when he saw, he's like, oh, yeah, that is him.
The Lego heart.
She's like, oh, yeah, they looked at your Lego and was like, oh, that is him, and rolled it up. I mean, I'm not. That happens a lot. I just don't tweet about it or Instagram about it every time I get stopped.
Right.
But my whole point. Oh fuck! What was the
keep Lego hearts in your car.
No,
yeah.
No.
Rice-a-roni, 69 cents.
It ain't fair. That's the point.
That was the point. It ain't fair.
It ain't fair.
Turtle wax. My whole point was that the conversation of. My whole point
the price
was
is wrong.
The conversation that this movie brought on after we saw it. Was me having explained that, yes, even in my privileged situation, that even I'm susceptible to that sort of treatment.
Definitely.
And it still happens.
You ain't LeBron.
Which, yeah.
Shoot, and even LeBron.
Yeah, but sometimes you still got to convince people of that. Because they just think, because you're on television, or white that you people. Got some dollars,
yeah.
That you're immune
that
to
is
it.
Immune, nah,
and
immune,
you're yeah. not. You're so not. And so, you know, I wanted to... My whole point of the song was I wanted to make a song that really speaks to liberals who, in the back of their mind, always have that conversation, a little tinge of doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And for people that just sort of sit on the sidelines. Because even when, like, you know, I had parents that, like, made you watch Eyes on the Prize.
Oh, yeah.
You know. Roots. Sit down and watch this.
Stand
right, right.
You, by you have... me. Oh, Lord.
Yes.
And, the thing is that whenever I watch these documentaries, the people that I always question the most aren't those that are committing the injustice is those that are on the sidelines just watching.
Yeah.
It's like the James Baldwin quote, is a thin line between what is it, a witness and a participant?
Yes.
You know, it's very thin. It's like
I almost have more hate for the witness.
Yeah.
That knows and won't
do anything.
Won't
at
do
least
anything.
Acknowledge it. Yeah. At least, and that's what we're going through now. It's like, oh God, please acknowledge it. And so and getting Bilal to sing the song.
Ooh, Bilal's on it?
Oh, yes, you know that already because I played it for you.
Yes, you did.
Edit.
Margaret for the win.
and getting Bilal to sing the song. Bilal is really the only singer that I could think of today that just encompasses everything that this ending was supposed to be. Gentle as a lamb, but ferocious as a lion.
He emotes.
It's a 7-minute song, which I let him go batshit crazy at the end.
Sometimes.
Any baby noises this time?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything. He just.
Wait, Catherine, was that
there's
the first
even
time?
A point where he threw down the microphone.
Is that the first time you heard Bilal sing before?
Yeah.
What did you feel the first
phenomenal.
Time?
Phenomenal. Phenomenal.
And it was kind of weird at the time because usually. When you get, quote, the credit song, that usually means that there might be a chance that you could get an Oscar. Usually for films of this nature.
Glory.
If this song is in the credits, then that means it could be a contender for an Oscar.
Song or whatever.
Yeah, and usually it's like, oh, man, okay, let's get that big name and let's go for it. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like I had to go with my conviction and... Go
that,
with
John
the right
shot.
Really shots fired.
Sorry. But not really.
You're like sorry.
Not sorry.
I had to go with what I felt was the right person that would really grasp your attention.
Yeah, he would do it.
And this was that. And I'm realizing that I've just spoken for the last 20 minutes.
Can I just ask Catherine a question?
By the way, we're back with Catherine.
It's funny. I just wanted to ask Catherine, so in the process of figuring out this song, this has to be huge, this has to emote, it has to do this, why Amir or The Roots or how was that called?
I love everything that he does. So, and I just thought it had the right, the right emotional gravitas. Mm. And for this piece, I mean, and when he saw the movie and then we talked, it was just like, it was perfect.
So was
but
the
you've
song
done that before, though. You've done that, like, you did that in Strange Days with Skunk Anansie with the last, like, so you, I've seen you do it, you know, you take like an unusual band or an unlikely choice and, you know, do it at the end. I thought that was dope, too.
Oh, good. It just seemed like a perfect fit.
Strange Days was my movie, by the way. Juliette Lewis. Oh my God.
Yeah.
You're the goat for that reference, Fonte.
Yeah.
I forgot about Skunk Anansie. All right. Well, it just hit me before I went on that 15-minute rant. I remember what my initial question was. Why did you want to do Detroit? No, I'm playing. But your preparation level, the way you shot the film, did you use stock film? Like, I don't know how to describe it. It almost feels like she dap kinged it.
Oh yeah.
What that mean?
She made it look vintage, like she was shooting on.
Oh, like Get Down. Old footage. How they did it first season.
No,
Get Down. Okay.
Everybody's
no. I thought. No. They used in the first. I said the first season.
Was, you just don't. Not yeah, a good thing was, to bring up here.
Damn.
No, even I know that.
Okay, so in the breaks, I don't know. Okay.
No, 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 no.
I mean, I'm sorry.
The Get Down. Back to Detroit. Let's get down in Detroit.
Yeah, was it? I mean, am I correct in that you used like certain?
We used lenses from the period, and yet digital cameras, and it was like maybe 2 weeks before we were going to start shooting. They made it possible to adapt those lenses to these brand new digital cameras, which are actually pretty small and fairly light, which gives you that sort of more nimble approach. But the vintage just gives the patina of period, and then I also intercut it with some documentary footage that, you know, so it kind of, I don't know, it coexisted, or I thought it coexisted fairly well to kind of give you the scope and feel and authenticity of the time,
right.
And that was kind of critical to me.
Now, I want to ask you about Will Poulter.
Yeah.
I'll go out there right now. I'll say that I'll be shocked if he doesn't get nominated for best. I don't know if
he's supporting.
Would he be supporting or would he? Is he main? Wouldn't you submit those names or does the company submit those names?
Oh, well, we haven't even talked about it.
I feel like if you submit him for best supporting actor, he will win. But his level of evil is, and the thing is, I know he's the opposite of that. Because I had to, the person that I saw the movie with the first time, I mean, she was all disheveled because, you know, of what he represented in his other films. And he's such a gentle English voice.
Yes.
And those things. So when you are portraying something that intense, when you yell cut, is it like, okay, where's my iPhone at? And, you know, okay, what's on television and the game? And, okay, you would order me a pizza. We're about to cut. Okay. I know that one of them had to go through some sort of therapy or some sort of process to get rid of that character.
Well, I mean, when I would say cut, first of all, he never lost his accent. He was in that accent for the movie 24/7 during the shoot. And in fact, off and on, yes. But when I would say cut, I'd look, where's Will? And I'd see him out on the porch and his head would be in his hands. Mm. I mean, it was really, really hard for him. and as it was for everybody. But I mean, it was extremely difficult for him.
Like, were they able to interact with each other?
Oh, yeah.
Off camera.
Oh, like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was good. Why don't you punch me a little harder?
I think because even like Tarantino said for Django that like he had to do some special things with the cast, you know, in between to make sure everybody was cool because it was so tense.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, I just, and I had a conversation with everybody going into this film. I said, you know, trying to give them, you know, a sense of what the lay of the land might be and how, you know, how at the end of the day they're going to be asked to talk about this movie, and are they comfortable talking about this? Are you comfortable performing this? You know, yes, this really happened, but that doesn't necessarily make it any easier. And so having that conversation, they were very prepared, or I felt that they were pretty prepared going in.
Did you have to do anything in terms of making sure you talk about things you had to do to make them comfortable? Did you have to do things to make them uncomfortable at times? It reminded me of
Spike Lee in the School Days.
Yeah, Spike Lee School Days.
Oh, yeah. He
would separate Saving Private Ryan, where he would.
Private Ryan did that too?
Yeah, Steven, he made all the guys that were going to get Private Ryan. They all had to do like PT and all this crazy physical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But Matt Damon didn't do any of it. Wow. So like they,
and it,
so
and
they
it really showed
they really had that contempt for him. Right. Like, we risking our ass, go say this motherfucker. You know what I mean? Like, they really had that. So did you have to do anything, stuff like that? Like,
the early in the shoot, they kind of kept each group kept to themselves just for that reason, because if they were too friendly, it might be too difficult. And then when they became more comfortable and more relaxed with it, and I felt more confident that they were in their character and they really understood their character, then they were very close with each other. But it's a full-on commitment. I mean, something like this, obviously.
Who's the technical advisor for the nuances of, like, the time, how, you know, this is Detroit, we talk about black folks, the slang, making it authentic.
Like, did you shoot it on location?
Or that too.
Well, we shot some of it in Detroit. Unfortunately, about a year before we started, we went there where we wanted to shoot. They had disbanded their incentives program, so I needed to go to Boston to save money.
Okay.
Because they have a rebate of, you know, 25% above and below the line, and Detroit, or rather Michigan, used to, but in their infinite wisdom, they disbanded it.
Detroit pulled the Detroit.
Yeah.
My state did that too. North Carolina did that too. Like, we shot Iron Man 3 and then was like, nah, we ain't doing that no more.
Yeah. And you know, it's crazy, because if there's ever a city that could use
the money,
you know, this tremendous amount of revenue, anyway, Detroit. No, but we shot a lot of it in Boston.
How many? Because there are a lot of exterior scenes.
Yeah.
How many blocks would you have to, transform to just to get it to look like that? At least how many?
Actually, not as much as you would think. I mean, it's fairly contained. I had an amazing production designer, Jeremy Hindle, who also did Zero Dark. And keeping it somewhat contained, and that's another benefit of a sort of documentary style. It's there isn't these big wide crane shots. I don't use cranes, you know, so you don't, you know, you're just right
here.
You're in the car or you're, you know, over the back of somebody. So it's intimate. And that actually is a benefit if you, you know, don't have like giant real estate in which to work with. So
is that so? Did the same thing go for the costume and wardrobe? Is it the same people from the other movies, or did you have to go a little special for that?
No, I used this wonderful woman Francine for wardrobe, and she was just she's just extraordinary. She got fabric from the period. She would like travel all over the country for fabric and then create these and then build these suits. And I mean, everything was just meticulous, just meticulous. And so that was, you know, we were really lucky to find those kind of artisans who did that. But we were a lot of research and trying the language. I mean, there's a lot. I spent time with Melvin Dismukes, who John Boyega played, and a little bit of time with Larry, the dramatics, the man from the dramatics. And it's hard for me to talk about this, even to this day. You know, he's really.
Does he have PTSD?
I would think so. And yeah, and then spent time with Julie, who was on the set every day with me, who the real
Julie.
She was
one of the, okay.
The Julie played by Hannah Murray in the film, and she, you know, she had to relive it, and she just, you know, I mean, sometimes I would do a take and I'd look over my shoulder and, you know, it would just be awful, and I'd think, you know, it can't have been like that, and she'd say it was worse.
Damn.
We know, well, in the book and history shown,
yeah,
what the end result of the court case was.
Nobody went to jail.
In the various, of course, in the various
lawsuits. Some things don't change.
In the various lawsuits that have recurred throughout the years of it, or the attempts to reopen the case. But always wondered if those two characters in particular, the two white women that were caught up in, did they ever have their own lawsuit or their own civil suit? And
you know, not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of, but no, I don't think so.
Yeah, because I looked all over the internet to see, could they at least get justice? And nah.
Wait, it's like shouldn't only people paying.
No, I'm just like, no.
Were they like, in the hotel? Were they in the hotel with the guys?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The real crime. The okay. real crime was yeah. that they yeah. were
in the hotel with the guys.
In the hotel with white women.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the test. Like, even if white women can't get justice, it's like, it's a lost cause, bro.
Yeah.
Like, if
isn't there a display about this in the new Smithsonian? I don't know if you heard about the Detroit riots, or did you get a chance to go?
No, not
okay.
no.
Okay.
Oh, the one in D.C.?
Yeah.
There's, you know, there's a riot section.
Yeah.
Of the Smithsonian.
Right. You can have one for every decade.
Yeah. No, there
that.
Is.
More than that.
It's a very lovely and beautiful display of all the riots that America.
Yo, that is so sad. It's so hilarious.
Yeah,
but God, man.
I mean, it goes from Black Wall Street in Oklahoma and right here is, you know, in Memphis, and here is Detroit, and here is Los Angeles.
And here's D.C. and here's Birmingham. All
that. Yeah. It's like, and they have extra room for the future ones that are about to.
Why are we laughing?
I don't know. But it's funny because it brings a
it's
question.
It's funny because it's true.
It brings a question about riots. And what do you think made the Detroit riots stand out from what else had happened?
And why
previously?
Couldn't they recover? Like, what do you.
Yeah.
In your research, I feel as though this riot currently has Detroit where they are now. Like, when I think of Detroit, I think of a sepia-toned, black and white, desolate.
Yeah, it's the American London.
Yeah. Mm.
And that is nice.
And it's, why do you think that they have yet to recover? And with the importance of you releasing this film on the 50th anniversary of those riots on August 4th, 2017.
Well, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think of the city as both equal parts resilient, and certainly the people I meet there really resilient, but at the same time, it's still a city that's been a war zone, and it hasn't really recovered from the war zone, and that's, you know, so it's kind of this weird dichotomy, and. I don't know.
I guess sometimes that's the right answer.
There's no answer.
I wish I knew.
Will we overcome?
Not
no,
to put you.
No, we ain't gonna overcome.
Not to put you on the spot, but I'm curious. I gotta ask. Do you feel like because of this movie and the subject matter and everything else that there should be? Is there a relationship with Detroit? I mean, I know you said you didn't shoot there, but a relationship in a way of like, you know, that since they have the water issue,
have they seen
many issues like. It's not just meant like, is there like a charitable relationship or do you ever think about that?
See, I think so, yes. They have seen it. We did a few screenings and now we're going there for a premiere. And we did shoot there for, you know, maybe 5-6 days.
Oh,
so
okay.
We did shoot something there.
So they got a little bit of the money from the...
Okay. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I mean, this is definitely a part of their past. And so... You know, but I think, I don't know, it speaks both to a kind of strength in that, I mean, there's a huge artist community there now, and that's kind of exciting and thriving, and yet at the same time, I mean, this tragedy is imprinted, you know, in the DNA of the city, mm-hmm. and yet, I mean, again, there's a tremendous amount of anger that precipitated it. But unlike, let's say, the Rodney King riot, I mean, that had a very specific flashpoint, the LA riots, whereas this was attritional. I mean, this was...
Right, because it wasn't one event that set off the riots. No. It was just like injustice and people were fed up.
Exactly. And so, you know, justice is the conversation, you know.
No justice, no peace.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't heal unless you're hurt, you know. So maybe there's a dialogue that can start in Detroit and... expand.
How many screenings have you done in Detroit, and what's the general?
How many screenings we did? We did a screening for the chief of police there.
Oh wow!
Oh boy!
How did that go?
He wants it to be required viewing for every member of law enforcement.
Yes.
Seriously?
He's a brother, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You serious?
Yes.
I got a response to that.
I don't believe it.
Word. Oh, that's great every time.
That's crazy to me. I that was the last thing I was going to expect.
Detroit is about to be the police eyes on the prize.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's like required. It's like the video they make you watch when you work for Pizza Hut or something.
Your training video.
Your training joy. Wow.
Just clean the water, man.
I know.
Right? Just clean the water.
I know. I think it's, you know, is there a way forward? I mean, certainly, and we've screened it for some faith-based groups, and, you know, we're trying to get it out there, and of course it comes out nationwide.
Yeah.
Maybe it can be of some help.
Open dialogue, more
open dialogue, exactly.
So once this is, like, when you put your baby away and you go to the premiere and you do the last press junket, and I'm sure that movie season's over after February Oscar time. At what point do you start researching your next project? Like, do you overlap, or are you going to swim in Hawaii for 2 weeks and just, like, you know, do you watch Friends on TBS? Like, do you
binge and Netflix?
Who watches Friends on TBS?
Man, whenever
it's unavoidable,
get to change the channel,
dude. It's unavoidable. Like, I've fallen down many a Friends rabbit hole. Like,
my rabbit hole is American Ninja Warrior.
Oh, ooh. No. It's supposed to be Family Guy. Okay, oh, we can do this all day.
So, for you, like, are you thinking about the next project?
No, I can't. I can't.
Yeah, but we're not acting like you. I mean, your average is a year and a half to 2 years between films. So it's like, I imagine that you at least have to research 6 to 7 months before you're like, all right, let's green like this.
But this got to be exhausting, though, right now. Like, do you even have the energy? Like,
but this is also your production company, correct? Like, is this...
Oh, I worked with them, with Annapurna, who are fabulous, on Zero Dark Thirty. And okay. So that was a good kind of, you know, continuity there. But, yeah, I don't know. This was a few years, actually, kind of 5 years from release to release. So it's been a little while.
So you're saying that maybe 2022?
No.
Can you go that long? Because, again, if you're not popcorn budget, you know, $250 million, I mean, I can imagine that the light bill has to be paid and stuff like that. So it would behoove you to at least know what the plan is for 2019.
It would. If you have any stories, I'm open. But yeah.
Would you go out of... Oh, wait, let me just ask. Would you ever go off type and just do...
Like a romantic comedy?
Like a test open position.
A musical.
Like Catherine Bigelow. Yeah, like a frothy.
Yeah.
You've Got Mail Part 2.
Oh, wow.
John Wick.
Think Like a Man. Hey.
John Wick. John
Wait, John Wick's your version of a romantic comedy? No.
A man and his dog.
Yeah, how do you, you know, when you're between projects, like financially, I mean, how do you make that work in terms of...
I do commercials.
Oh, okay.
Wait, are y'all saying that Catherine go broke in between projects? Because I imagine...
No,
I
don't see, but just oh, real bro, artists, just, yeah. Real artists have to keep jobs.
Yeah.
I have 19... Yes.
This He's got like 20 jobs.
I have 19 jobs.
No, I
yeah.
Okay.
I got jobs.
One job, one job does not pay me...
Enough to only do that
to pay
one job.
You. Right. One job does not pay me enough to pay you guys.
Okay,
I gotta unpaid. Have.
This is fascinating.
So commercials, that's like you do those kind of in your.
I do,
and
Are you? Do you?
Use a different name.
Alan Smithy.
Alan Smithy.
No, but.
So you don't like the Heinz ketchup commercial, or Japanese commercials, like.
I haven't done those, but. I don't know, it's interesting because that's where I can kind of maybe check out of content a little bit and just look at it from an equipment and technical standpoint, you know, just the mechanics of film. And
I figure that's harder, though, because you have to tell a story in 30 seconds, which you specifically, I don't know if it's like the level of your commercials are, you know, Mercedes or Classy Curl, like.
Did you say Classy Curl?
I'm sorry, I was watching the Soul Train episode before I got here, so in my head, he gets squirrel.
That's still a product.
Curly, yes, girl. I'm sorry. I digress. What I'm saying is, when you do commercials, is it harder to make an impact or tell the story in 30 seconds to a minute, however long the commercial is? Than it is to tell a story in which you have complete control of.
I don't know. I like the I kind of like the challenge of, you know, like 30 seconds or a minute. You know, you just, I mean, it's a deep dive.
Can you give an example of a commercial that you've done that we've all seen?
But it's a different part of your brain, right?
I mean, it's a different part of your brain.
That's how
exactly.
I look at them. Yeah. When I do commercials, it's like one thing, and when you do creative things, yeah. It's a totally different thing.
Yeah.
Bill Sherman, ladies and gentlemen.
But it's hard.
He is here.
Dude, it's hard.
It's
like,
not
at Fallon, my version of the commercial.
The sandwiches.
Yeah, when they ask us to do 7-second stingers.
Yeah.
So if there's a new bit, you know, Sidewalk Movies, mm-hmm. and they need usually like Mark or Stro Elliott. Yeah, but that's not my world.
That's because that's where you come from. You come from long form. But
again,
people come from short
the song
form.
I submitted to her film is seven minutes and 9 seconds.
And but that's not real life.
It's all below for like 3 minutes.
Because I knew he has to simmer and cook. He's not microwave. He's, yeah. You know, but at Fallon, you got to have a catchy ass jingle in 7 seconds.
In radio, you're supposed to talk for 30 seconds sometimes and a minute and...
But sometimes you have a script and, you know,
right.
You get into a rhythm of, mm-mm. How's your day? Or 59. And this is CNC mm-mm. Music Factory.
Yeah, the guy who did the, it was similar to what Catherine was saying. The guy that did I was reading the interview, the guy that did the Windows startup music.
So oh, yeah. Right.
And he was saying how that was like, once he got into that, like he had to do, God, however many revisions until they finally... Got it. But he said, like, once he was so used to working in, like, that little 5 or 6 seconds, once he sat down to write a song,
oh, yeah.
That felt like that, a universe.
That's like, my life. Like, I can't write a 3.5-minute song anymore. I can crush a minute, but I can't.
Yeah, that's right, because at Sesame Street, yeah. Your songs are, like, 90 seconds.
Yeah, at the most.
Catherine Bell is the music director at Sesame Street.
I'm the verse chorus out cat. Like, I don't do bridges
no
anymore.
Bridges.
I'm new.
Electric Company.
Get right to the point.
I see.
Anyway, that's not what we're talking about. Catherine Bigelow. Hey, can I ask a question?
What's more interesting?
Since I'm talking, my 15-year-old me would be super pissed if you didn't bring up Point Break in this conversation.
Yes.
Part of me wants to be like, remember when you made Point Break? Because it's awesome. But like, did you have any concept of the impact that movie would have? And like that we were talking about, like, the thing like TBS Friends. Like if Point Break comes on the television, I can't
stop
watching
like it.
Like wait, I'm done for the next hour and a half. Or
Bill,
long
can what? Can I add on to that?
Yes, please. You're the boss.
Are you even, Catherine? Are you even aware of this new embracing of Point Break from millennials? Like for some reason, usually on weekends, I will go to a movie theater and see a throwback film. Like some art house film will, you know, show right. like an old. And what's weird is that there's a new culture of this generation that looks at intense drama films as comedies. And when I saw Point Break at the Nighthawk like 3 months ago, any line that Keanu Reeves says.
I was about to say, any Keanu movie though now is a comedy.
But like Busey, Keanu Reeves, I mean, there's so many. Yeah. It's like the whole thing is amazing.
But I realized he was this most Keanu in Point Break.
Yeah,
dude, more than any. Because he could be. He was free. It was like, I could be me.
So what was it like in your head? Did you have any idea that 25 years from now, like, dude, God. That voice is like
it's the best. I mean, like,
whoa! What more way? Like, how do you direct that film where it's? But he's Californian, because I know a lot of dudes that talk like that in California. So right. It's almost like what's going on in your head as he's acting? Like, you're just like, oh, that's Ted from Excellent Adventure.
Well, that was
And you could be honest.
No, it was...
Because I see you trying to form the words.
No, it was actually a real challenge to get the movie made with somebody who didn't have that kind of,
acting
action.
Acting experience?
No.
Oh, action experience.
Whoa,
wrong word. I'm sorry.
And coming from Bill and Ted's, you're like, okay, well, now how can he, Right. It was just trying to process that, and I don't know. I thought he was.
Was it sold to you?
Extremely talented.
Or
No.
You say I want that guy?
No, I want that guy.
Oh, you did. Yeah. Okay.
And what did they? What did Hollywood say? What did the producers say?
Well,
I want Keanu Reeves.
No.
And they're like the Bill and Ted guy.
Because I'm sorry.
It's just the way that. How can I say it? I mean, I was just convinced that he'd be perfect for this part. He was Johnny Utah. That was the name of the piece. Originally, and then I finally found a producer who, again, just like Hurt Locker, was like, okay, we'll take a flyer, and said yes. So I was really lucky.
Were you surprised at the success of it?
Yeah.
And, I believe that.
And when you saw the remake.
Oh. I didn't see it.
Okay.
I didn't see it. I'm so glad you asked that live. Yeah, I was just going to ask it.
But did you see Point Break live? Any of you?
What? There's a live Point Break?
Oh, it's been for years.
I don't understand. What is this?
What?
It's a performance. I don't have anything to do with it. All I know, it's called Point Break Live. It's probably here somewhere.
Probably
certainly
UCB.
It's in. Right. It was in Los Angeles. And I went with Edgar Wright one time because he wanted to see it, and he wanted to see
Edgar
it.
Edgar Wright?
Yeah, I know.
The Edgar Wright?
I know, yeah. Nice. And
no, a different one.
Shut up, Bill.
Yeah, the other one. The one
Edgar
that
Wright,
didn't, yeah.
Yeah,
the one that didn't do Shaun of the
Dead.
Right.
Body.
Right. Exactly. Right, that one. And anyway, there's a character in it that plays me. It's very funny. She's like got a megaphone, and half the time, it's really, you buy your ticket, and they give you a... like a clear poncho because for the wave sequences they throw water all over you. No,
I want to go.
We need to go there.
I want to go there
collectively.
And,
QLS field trip.
And they pick somebody from the audience for Keanu each night and they give them a card that Yeah, so it could be.
Oh, that's awesome.
You
could be Keanu.
Does this still happen?
Dude.
It's going on for years.
Did they invite
years.
You or did you just show ambush
no,
one night?
No,
like,
we just ambushed. But then they realized it was that I was there. And then, when they robbed the banks, well, they came and robbed both Edgar and I. We took everything. Everything that we had, they took. And, it was fabulous.
That is
so
hilarious.
Oh, that's great.
I don't know.
I'm looking on Google right now.
Yeah, so am I.
Catherine, have you ever had an issue with someone taking direction from you because they've never worked with a female director?
Good question.
Wow. Well,
now it's deep.
You don't have to name names. You don't have to name names unless you'd like to.
Busey. I think I don't know. I think either I've been lucky or, you know, I steer clear of
assholes.
Exactly. You know, but, I mean, you know, you can sense a sort of attitude, mm-hmm. and I move away. I move in the opposite direction. Yeah. but no, I've been really lucky. You know, crew and cast.
One thing I was always curious about, for the time that you were with James Cameron.
Yeah.
What was it like to be, you know, for two creative people in one household? What was that like?
Well,
now come the hard hitters.
Yeah, sexism, and now who you used to be married to. Let's play ball.
That was. I mean, we're actually great friends. So I mean, it was kind of fabulous for the time that it was fabulous until it was no longer fabulous. But. I mean, we talk a lot about film, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, just.
Did you steer each other away from projects? Like, so I wouldn't.
Two film nerds in the same household.
A lot of that. Like, right. You know, why are you using so many close-ups? Why are you using so many, why are you using a wide angle? Why are you using a 24 when you could use this 300? You know, it's that kind of conversation.
Wow.
So what was it like to
ask,
win?
I gotta ask,
What was it like to win an Oscar over your ex-husband?
Yes! Yes.
Let your petty fly. Go
come on.
I completely was surprised. I mean, I thought 100% it was Avatar.
Yeah.
I was not in any way.
So in that any point, did you give him a side eye as you walked up to the podium?
No.
A little extra switch, like, hey, boom.
No.
She definitely
told you
like
you
the
used
type
a 24 one.
And he was looking good at them Oscars. Hey, boom. Yes.
Well,
Catherine's not playing with us.
Yes, I know. We're silly like that. We're just trying to be very respectful and use the good china.
That room you don't go in.
China.
Yeah exactly. China.
Normally we had a paper plates out. But we got an Oscar winner here today.
Yeah.
Had to bring it out of China cabinet.
Well, no, I figured at some point you might get tired of having to represent the what's it like to be at the mountaintop in the boys' club and da 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 da. I know it gets tiresome and that you would want to just be a director, not the first female or history making. So,
is there a female director collective? Like,
well, there's a kind of like that at the DGA, Directors Guild of America, the steering committee, and I mean, you know, I suppose my feeling is, I've always resisted a conversation about your woman doing. You know, I think that kind of ghettoizes women. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, it actually prevents a perceptual, in other words, it siloizes them. And so, you know, I think of myself as a filmmaker. I don't think of myself as a woman director. Yeah,
exactly. So you there's know, no Sundays with Sophia and Ava having lunch. And
I just don't think of that, only because I think it, well, I don't think like that, because I think it perpetuates that inequity.
But what about from a mentorship standpoint? Because I'm guessing that there is an inequity in the numbers of female directors, and
like 7%. You mean that that kind of inequity?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Sound like 60 cents to a dollar to me, but
or these less. Are real facts.
Facts, but yeah. So what about on that note? Because there is a dichotomy of okay, I don't want to be the female director, but hey, it's not a lot of us. So how do I?
So is there an end game where you become Murrow? Like, do you run? Do you imagine like maybe 15 years from now you will have your own Paramount? Where you?
Wow.
Make sure that, again, like again, you said that, you already said that you don't want to focus on the sex of it, but at least from what you know, and I know that you've had a lot of mansplaining done in your life and a bunch of no's told to you, and you've saw injustice where your male counterparts wouldn't have gotten that, and sure, petty shit like, well, I think it should be done this way, and that whatever. So is there any desire to, I would like to open my own production company and give fellow me's out there a voice or that sort of thing?
Well, I'm Well, I'm working with, I do, you know, I'm producing a couple of things, and I try to, you know, I try to give back in that way, and, mm-hmm. and I suppose also in the world of philanthropy, as I said, elephant conservation or any wildlife trafficking conservation. So you try to give back in a way that's meaningful. But I also am a creative advisor at Sundance, and that's where mm-hmm. I sort of spend most of my energy of trying to
even out the score.
Even well, yeah, to a certain extent. On the other hand, I sort of always walk away from that feeling like I get way more than anybody else. You know, it's just, I don't know, do you know, the kind of, I don't presume to be able to, I mean, I never want to tell somebody what to do. I just want to do what I do and hope that inspires others to carry on. And I always tell them, don't take no for an answer. No doesn't exist. In your world, in your universe, no doesn't exist.
Well said.
He likes that one.
I know this much. Thank you very much, Catherine Bigelow, for coming on Questlove Supreme. I appreciate
it. Thank you. All of you. All of you.
And on behalf of Boss Bill, Unpaid Bill, Sugar Steve, Fontigolo, and Laia, a.k.a. Margaret, we thank you, Catherine Bigelow, for coming on the show. Reminding all of you people out there, go see Detroit, have conversations about what's going on. Get involved. Just don't be a couch critic and criticize your television. Go do something about it. This is Questlove Supreme. Thank you very much. I will see you the next go-round. Wish you love. Peace. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.